Involved insects. We have talked about gnats and we have talked about flies. Today we're going to talk about locusts a little bit. And we don't know the identification of all of these insects, but probably as I pointed out a couple weeks ago, they are some of them actually not just annoying but actually attacking people. And I don't know if it was because I needed that lesson reinforced, but this morning I was walking to the missionary cottage to unlock, and I got stung by a bee right here by my sideburn. So I thought, well, this must be what it felt like for these folks in Egypt. And if I say anything this morning that sounds a little crazy, or if I keel over, you have some explanation. It's still a little bit sore and kind of tingly along the side of my face. But Lord willing, we can make progress through this passage and take away what the Lord has for us here. I want to begin with a statement that some of you will recognize, and it is as follows. Quote, "What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us." What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And that is from the pen of A.W. Tozer. And it's a statement that gets your attention, but it's also very controversial, depending on who you ask. And you know how it is. Sometimes preachers get a little carried away trying to make a point and overstate things. And we tend to be given to hyperbole. And actually, I think that that is an overstatement. In fact, C.S. Lewis said that the most important thing about you is not what you think about God, it's actually what God thinks about you. And that's pretty thought-provoking. Whether you call it the most important thing about you, Tozer was certainly onto something important, especially in the terms that he went on to explain after that statement. He said this, "The history of mankind will probably show that no people has ever risen above its religion or worship, and man's spiritual history will positively demonstrate that no religion has ever been greater than its idea of God. Worship is pure or base as the worshiper entertains high or low thoughts of God. For this reason, the gravest question before the church is always God himself. And the most portentous fact about any man is not what at a given time, what he at a given time may say or do, but what he in his deep heart conceives God to be like." Let me dwell on that for a minute. This is really the point that Tozer is making. When you're looking at yourself as an individual in God's world, the main issue is not what you say or what you do, as important as those things are. It is the understanding of God that is behind how you actually live. We tend, by a secret law of the soul, to move toward our mental image of God. This is true not only of the individual Christian, but of the company of Christians that composes the church. Always, the most revealing thing about the church is her idea of God. He says, there's this law, this principle of reality, that whatever our conception of God is, we tend to be drawn to that in the direction of our lives and the values of our lives, the choices that we make. Your concept of God has this powerful shaping influence. Now, why do I bring that up this morning? It is because throughout this series on the plagues, we have continually been confronted with truths about God. There has been application of that to our lives. But a lot of the content of these passages and of these messages has been straightforward theology. And what Tozer is saying has everything to do with these passages and what we get out of them and why we study them and why we appreciate them. What he's saying is that by its very nature, theology is practical. Your concept of God has this shaping, this influencing effect on how you think and how you live. And you could think of it this way with just these passages. How would our lives be different if you and I internalized and consistently bore in mind what we have been seeing about God in the book of Exodus? What would be the impact on our interactions with people, on our thinking about our life in general, about specific choices that we make? If we truly bore in mind and were shaped by the truths here about God's power and God's sovereignty, God's judgment of sin, and more than anything, God's faithfulness to his covenant, how would those kinds of truths affect our attitudes, our choices, our relationships, our response to difficulty in life, our response to temptation in life, our service for the Lord? Well, I know the Lord understands that it can take a long time for these basic things about him to truly sink into our consciousness to the point where they begin to transform us. And that's probably one reason that the story of the Exodus is so long and keeps rehearsing these things from different angles over and over again. I mean, so far we have covered 9 chapters in 13 sermons, and we've only gotten through 7 plagues. And there's actually quite a bit left before these people are out of Egypt. This morning, we're going to consider plagues 8 and 9, which are the plagues of the locusts and then the plagues of the darkness. And you may remember from last week that those two are in a triplet along with the one from last week, which was the plague of hail in chapter 9. So we're not leaving all of that behind. These really do go together in a set. But I want to point out that these two, the locust and the darkness, actually share something important in common, and that's going to lead us to our theme here in just a moment. And what I'd like us to do is to begin by reading chapter 10. First of all, about the locust, beginning in verse 1. Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Go unto Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I have dealt harshly with the Egyptians." And that expression could also be translated, "how I have made fools of the Egyptians, and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am Yahweh." So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh and said to him, "Thus says Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go that they may serve me. For if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your country, and they shall cover the face of the land so that no one can see the land. And they shall eat what is left to you after the hail, and they shall eat every tree of yours that grows in the field. And they shall fill your houses and the houses of all your servants and of all the Egyptians, as neither your fathers nor your grandfathers have seen from the day they came on earth to this day." Then he turned and went out from Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh's servants said to him, "How long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go that they may serve Yahweh their God. Do you not yet understand that Egypt is ruined?" So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, "Go, serve Yahweh your God. But which ones are to go? Moses said, "We will go with our young and our old. We will go with our sons and daughters and with our flocks and herds, for we must hold a feast to Yahweh." But he said to them, "Yahweh be with you if I ever let you and your little ones go. Look, you have some evil purpose in mind. No, go the men among you and serve Yahweh, for that is what you're asking." And they were driven out from Pharaoh's presence. Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, so that they may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every plant in the land and all that the hail has left." So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and Yahweh brought an east wind upon the land all that day and all that night. When it was morning, the east wind had brought the locusts. The locusts came up over all the land of Egypt and settled on the whole country of Egypt, such a dense swarm of locusts as had never been before, nor will ever be again. They covered the face of the whole land, so that the land was darkened, and they ate all the plants in the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Not a green thing remained, neither tree nor plant of the field through all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh hastily called Moses and Aaron and said, "I have sinned against Yahweh your God and against you. Now therefore, forgive my sin, please, only this once, and plead with Yahweh your God only to remove this death from me." So he went out from Pharaoh and pleaded with Yahweh, and Yahweh turned the wind into a very strong west wind, which lifted the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. Not a single locust was left in all the country of Egypt, but Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go. And so, plague number 9, the plague of the darkness, verse 21. Then Yahweh said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, a darkness to be felt." So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was pitch darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days, but all the people of Israel had light where they lived. Then Pharaoh called Moses and said, "Go, serve Yahweh. Your little ones also may go with you. Only let your flocks and your herds remain behind." But Moses said, "You must also let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings that we may sacrifice to Yahweh our God. Our livestock also must go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind, for we must take of them to serve Yahweh our God, and we do not know with what we must serve Yahweh until we arrive there." But Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. And Pharaoh said to him, "Get away from me. Take care never to see my face again, for on the day you see my face, you shall die." Moses said, "As you say, I will not see your face again." And these are the words of the Lord for us. How are those two plagues similar? You probably could pick out a few different ways, but I want to point out one as we get to the theme for the message this morning. Of course, we understand the nature of the ninth plague, and that is that darkness encompassed the land of Egypt for 3 days. But did you pick up what verse 15 said about the other plague, the locust plague? It tells us that the locust covered the face of the whole land so that the land was darkened. And the verb translated "was darkened" is from the same root as the noun for darkness in the next plague. In other words, both of these plagues are associated with darkness. In the one, the ground was dark and you couldn't see it because it was covered over by a host of locusts. And in the other, the entire environment was dark. And so I want to preach to you on this theme, what the darkness reveals about God. What the darkness reveals about God. And I thought about a statement in Psalm 139. Where the psalmist is giving all these possibilities of trying to get away from the presence of God. And he says, if I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. So in that case, the point he's making is, God can see through whatever darkness that affects human beings. Nothing is dark to him, and therefore no way can we hide from the Lord by trying to cover ourselves with some kind of darkness. But what we learn in Exodus is not just that God sees through the darkness, but actually that the darkness illumines us in the sense that it is teaching us about the Lord. Usually, we connect the idea of darkness with that which is evil. And in fact, sometimes the Bible also refers to darkness as an image having to do with Satan and his evil forces and his evil work in the world. But folks, God is sovereign over the darkness, and in this case, he even uses the darkness to put his own character and his own works on display for everybody to behold. So even though the darkness would seem to limit visibility, actually what's happening is God is using the darkness to open our eyes to further things about him. The darkness is revealing the Lord. And so the question is, what does it reveal about the Lord? What are these two plagues intended to convey about him? Again, we could come up with a number of truths from this passage, but I'm going to highlight three. And again, they are particularly ones that are brought out by these two plagues in a unique way. We've been trying to highlight those concepts that are unique to the particular plagues we're looking at. And so we have these three. And here's the first one that I would give you. Here's one of the things that we learn about God from this darkness period. First of all, that God desires to be known transgenerationally. That's a big word. I'll say it again. God desires to be known transgenerationally. In other words, over the course of time. In other words, this is not just limited to Israel at this moment getting out of Egypt and God dealing with this one Pharaoh. There are realities about the Lord that through these events he is working to convey to future generations. And that is his intent, or one of his purposes through all of this. He desires to be known transgenerationally. He makes that point explicitly at the beginning of the locust plague. It's the first time in these stories that he's really brought this out. And we'll look at it, but let's think about the locust for a moment. Not usually something that we have to be concerned about in this country. But to this day, you are familiar, I'm sure, with the fact that countries in Africa and the Middle East are fairly regularly invaded by swarms of locusts. In fact, at the end of 2019, very recently, those kinds of animals invaded the country of Kenya to the point where we're told it became the worst locust plague that that country has suffered in something like 70 years. So it is not ancient history. This still goes on to a small degree, but it gives us some sense of what this must have been like. And I read to you from the BBC website. Desert locust, or Schistocerca gregaria, have often been called the world's most devastating pest, and for good reason. Swarms form when locust numbers increase and they become crowded. It's not a hard concept. They reproduce to the point where they cannot survive on the environment in which they are living. This causes a switch from a relatively harmless, solitary phase to a gregarious, sociable phase, which is why the word gregaria is used for them. You think gregarious has to do with people being really friendly and talkative? They're socializing. Well, what is the socialization that's going on here? In this phase, the insects are able to multiply 20-fold in 3 months and reach densities of 80 million per square kilometer. Each can consume 2 grams of vegetation every day. Now, that may not seem like a whole lot, but the reality is that corresponds to their body weight. Take whatever your body weight is, don't say it out loud, and imagine eating that much food in 1 day. That's what we're talking about here. That's how hungry these pests are and how ravaging they are of the environment. Combined, a swarm of 80 million can consume food equivalent to that eaten by 35,000 people each day. You get the kind of numbers that they had just in 2019, and every day these locusts are eating the amount of food that would be eaten by 35,000 people a day. And another website says locust swarms as large as 926.6 square miles, or more than 3 times the size of New York City, have been seen in Northeast Kenya. If you've been to New York City, and just think about the whole thing and all the boroughs, and multiply that by 3, and imagine a swarm of these locusts that big, there were swarms of that size, which can contain up to 192 billion locusts, and in those numbers, it's estimated they can eat in 1 day the same amount as 90 million people. So it's not just that they are annoying, and even if they don't particularly harm you physically, this is a devastating development because the result is all the agriculture is wiped out, leading to widespread famine and the refugee crises that come out as a result of this, people displaced, going anywhere to find food. And this plague recorded in the verses I read would have been much worse than any of those modern plagues. And for one, because it all started overnight. There wasn't this long lead up to it. The passage says that Moses stretched out his staff, and there was this east wind that the Lord brought, and overnight, when it was morning, the east wind had brought the locusts. And to highlight further that this was a supernatural thing, not just kind of the normal process of reproduction and travel or weather, we read that the locusts came from the west. In other words, there was this eastward wind that brought them there, where typically, and even to this day, these things come up from the south. This is an unusual development. And it's striking. People tend to see that detail, both of how it started and how it ended. They tend to see it as pointing ahead to something that's going to happen in chapter 14. Because in chapter 14, we read that Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry by sea dry land, and the waters were divided. Same process. Wind from the west, an eastward wind, and it's at work all night, and by the time the morning comes, these waters are divided. And then guess how all of that ended once the people of Israel got through the Red Sea? Well, as we go on to read in this story, we read about how these animals settled on the whole country, such a dense swarm of locusts as had never been before, nor will ever be again, covered the face of the whole land. The land was dark, and all the plants that were left over from the hail got taken up, got eaten up by these bugs. And the Lord dissipates this whole plague just as quickly as he brought it there. Because in verse 19 it says, he turned the wind into a very strong west wind, which lifted the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. And listen to the totality of this. Just like they did away with everything that they ran across, now every last one of them is out of there. Not a single locust was left in all the country of Egypt. And what does that point toward? When it talks about the west wind and these animals being driven into the Red Sea and evidently drowning there. That's exactly what happened in chapter 14 when the Lord brings the people of Israel through. The waters come crashing down, and it is the Egyptians that are swallowed up by the Red Sea. Total devastation. And what was the point of all of that? We understand the point was, in general, put pressure on these people. Bring Pharaoh to the point where he is broken and he's willing to let the people go. That's in general what's going on with all the plagues, but for this plague, something pretty specific is mentioned at the outset. So I want to have you look back at the first couple of verses. Exodus 10:1. When the Lord gives a purpose for what he's doing, he says, first of all, that I may show these signs of mine among them. So he wants to reveal himself. The signs are pointing to something about him. But then he says, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I have dealt harshly with the Egyptians and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am Yahweh. And what I'm pointing out is that that is a new emphasis in the story of the plagues. God is doing something spectacular here, and he says at this point, my purpose is specifically so that this story would be told generation after generation. And so that through the telling of that story, later generations would come to know me. In verse 2, when he says, that you may know that I am Yahweh, the word you is plural. And it refers to all of the Israelites going down through the corridors of time. And we've seen this language before about that you may know that I'm Yahweh. But in the story of the plague, so far, those references have been to Pharaoh or the people of Egypt, that through those events, they might know something of Yahweh. This is the first time in the stories of the plagues that the Lord now takes that language and he applies it, I would say, redemptively to what he desires for his own covenant people. And again, it's not just the generation that went through this. It is so that this story, because it is so dramatic and so obviously supernatural, and the devastation was so great, that the memory of that would live on, and that it would be told generation after generation, and that the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren would be blown away by what the Lord was able to do, and so that through the telling of the story, they might come to know the Lord. Now, let me have you look at another passage to see how this was supposed to work. There are in the book of Psalms what we call a few, not many, but historical psalms. And I want you to look at one of them in particular, and that is Psalm 78, where the psalmist is attempting to do the very thing that our passage is talking about, to pass on the memory of the great works of God to the later generations. Look at Psalm 78. Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I'll open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from of old, things that we have heard and known, that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, but tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of Yahweh and his might and all the wonders that he has done. This man, guided by the Spirit, is working to do the very thing that was on God's heart for his own time period and the generations that he was directly responsible for. And that's why he goes into the pretty long passage that is Psalm 78, and a number of different stories about the history of God's people. But I want to point out that it's not just that, okay, that we may know these things, that we might have this knowledge in our head. It's the very point that Tozer was making, so that that would lead you to a particular response to the Lord, you and your children and your grandchildren. Notice what he goes on to say, verse 5. He established a testimony in Jacob, appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers to teach to their children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and arise and tell them to their children, so that they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and that they should not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit was not faithful to God. Now, a number of thoughts are introduced in those statements. It is not just so that they would understand God is powerful and that he judges non-Israelites. That's true, and there are truths to be learned about the Lord along those lines, but he's applying it to them specifically, and he says, look, part of this is so that you may hope in the Lord. When you're in a crisis, when you're in bondage, when the wicked are afflicting you, look back on these stories, and having been taught these things by your parents, you have a solid, objective, historical basis for having hope that God is also for you, on your side, and able to deliver you. That's one of the applications. It's also so that you may obey his law. If this God is so mighty that he did this, and then he comes along and he says, now Israel, in the Mosaic Covenant, here's how I want you to live. It makes total sense that I would arrange my life under the law that he has given. He is God after all. Look at his power and sovereignty and glory. So that I might hope in him, so that I might obey him, and so that I might remain tender in my heart toward him and not be like so many of their predecessors, their ancestors were. In fact, it's a very sad thing. We won't take the time to look at this, but later in the psalm, he actually describes in poetic terms the plagues that we're looking at, and he speaks about what the Lord did and how nevertheless that same generation tested and rebelled against the Most High God, did not keep his testimonies, turned away, acted treacherously, twisted like a deceitful bow, provoked God to anger, moved him to jealousy with their idols. And there's this rebuke that is looking at all these past generations that did not internalize the knowledge of God and whose lives were not characterized by God-centered hope, submissive obedience, tender heart to the Lord. They're filled with stubbornness just like Pharaoh was. And God intends the stories to help a new generation avoid the cycle of rebellion and destruction. So, if God intends to be known through these stories transgenerationally, I want to tell the children and the young people in our congregation this morning, and as you've been hearing all these messages, all these stories about what God did to Egypt, they are for you just as much as they are for your parents. And it is not to teach you that God is a meanie who goes around beating people up whenever he feels like it. It does teach you that sin and rebellion have terrible consequences, but there is so much more about the Lord that we are discovering here. And what this was all about, it really was a means to a greater end. Yes, he was judging the wicked, but it was so that he would be able to fulfill his covenant promises to Israel and move them on to the next stage of enjoying his presence among them and being instructed about the best way to live and being brought into the blessing of the promised land to prepare the way for the Messiah to come through whom all families of the earth would be blessed. This is what we want to be taking away, including our children. And that if you trust in this God, rather than try to fight against him. If you will give your life to this God, he will protect you from the wrath that is to come upon the world, and he will do whatever is necessary to keep his word for you, not just for your parents. And this business about the locust and the teaching of it is used in other places in Scripture, as the Lord will use locusts later on to deal with rebels and to vindicate his people. You see that in the famous prophecies, for example, in the book of Joel about other locust plagues. And you see it ultimately in Revelation chapter 9 in what is a locust plague that, because of the supernatural demonic power that is associated with this, ends up being so much worse than anything ever experienced. Listen to this, Revelation 9. Then from the smoke out of this bottomless pit came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green plant or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. There is a greater locust plague coming through which human beings will be devoured who, because of having rejected Jesus, do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So it is not just God's past use of locusts, but God's future use of locusts should also move us, and again, addressing the younger people, it should move the young people to repent of your sins and to turn to Christ and then to live for Christ. And both the past and the future ought also to motivate the parents that are here not to grow weary of declaring to our children the mighty works of God and the blessings of seeking refuge in the salvation that this God has provided through Jesus. God desires for us to take away from these stories a greater commitment to proclaim him and his works to the next generation. That is one of the main truths that we learn about him from the darkness, but there is a second one that we come to now. And that is that God rules over life and death. God rules over life and death. That idea is hinted at in the locust plague, because when it hit and Pharaoh makes another one of his pseudo-confessions, he says in verse 19, plead with the Lord your God only to remove this death from me. He describes the locust plague, even though, as far as we know, nobody immediately died from that. Because of the famine that is to come, is probably what he has in mind when he describes it as this death, take it away. But the idea of life and death comes out even more when we think about the plague of the darkness itself. It is described in verse 21 as a darkness to be felt. It is described as literally darkness of darkness, or total or pitch darkness, in verse 22. And apparently it wasn't just that the light of the sun went out, but that other lights as well would not work, because verse 23 says that all the people of Israel had light where they lived, in their dwellings. I don't know how this worked, but evidently the sun was obscured throughout Egypt. If you went into an Egyptian house, and just to modernize it a little bit, they might have some flashlights or some emergency lights. Everybody's battery was dead, and they couldn't turn on their car to turn on their headlights. Not a single light, no matter what it was, worked. But you go over to Goshen, or where the Israelites lived, and their flashlights are doing just fine. And they are able somehow to get light, or maybe it was some kind of just supernatural light that the Lord just spoke into being to help them through this time. Think about all the practical problems that would have resulted from the absence of light. If there had been any plants or any scrap of a plant left over from the plagues, they didn't understand this, I don't guess, but there is something called photosynthesis that requires that light be present in order for plants to grow. That form of life could not have been generated without light. Just like with you and I today, when we are in the dark, there's this automatic feeling of danger. Like, I don't know what's lurking out there that might attack or try to hurt me. And then there is just the total disorientation that you can imagine, where this went on for 3 days without any kind of light, just total darkness. Maybe you've had an experience where you have gone down into a cave underneath the earth on some kind of tourist attraction. And it is a disconcerting thing when they say, all right, everybody turn out your flashlights or whatever. You can feel the darkness. You feel destabilized. You are fearful. You don't know how much to move before you run into somebody else or run into something that's going to hurt you. It's disorienting. And they usually just tell you to do that for just a few minutes to sort of get the feel. All right, turn the lights back on. This went on like this for 3 days. And so the people's lives came to a grounding halt. The only thing they could do was to stay at home, unproductive, and uncertain about the future of how this is going to be resolved. Now, biblically, and we're very close here to the book of Genesis, another way to look at this is that you are witnessing here an undoing of creation. After the Lord created the heavens and the earth, what was the very first thing he did? It was, let there be light, and there was light, and he separated the light from darkness, and that created these categories of evening and morning, and the concept of day. At this point, it's like all of that is being undone for just a brief span of 3 days, making the point about God being the ruler over all of creation, all of life, as darkness enshrouds everything once again. And those were all aspects of what is going on here. But there was more than that, and this is, I think, the main point. We want to remember, as I've tried to point out, that these different plagues were directed against the gods of Egypt. And I have introduced you to some of these gods. In some of these cases, we are more sure about the connection than others, so I try not to speculate too much as we've been going through this. But I would imagine that if you have heard anything about the gods of Egypt, you have heard about their devotion toward the sun. And the sun god that they worshipped, actually, it was more than one sun god. The sun had a central place in their pantheon, and it was associated with the life that these people enjoyed and wanted to continue. And I read you here from one commentator. He says, the Egyptians served Horus, the god of the sunrise, Aten, the god of the round midday sun, and Atum, the god of the sunset. So we like to look at the sunrise or the sunset when we're out for vacation or whatever. And as they thought about it, there was one god for the rising sun and one god for the sun at midday when it's totally brilliant and one god for the sunset. But the supreme deity in their national pantheon was Amun-Re, who said, quote, in one of their myths, I am the great god who came into being of himself, he who created his names, he who has no opponent among the gods. In fact, Amun-Re was believed to be the creator, not just of himself, but the creator and sustainer of all life on earth. And we sang some songs to Yahweh, to Jesus this morning. Here is one of their songs to Amun-Re. Unique God, There is none besides him. You mold the earth to your wish, you and you alone, all people, herds and flocks, all on earth that walk on legs, all on high that fly with their wings. This was their theology, that the Son God created himself and then turned around and created everything else. And one writer goes on to say, every morning the rising of the sun in the east reaffirmed the life-giving power of Amun-Re. Sunset represented death and the underworld, but the rise of Amun-Re on the next day offered the hope of resurrection. For the Egyptians, it was a matter of faith that the eternally rising sun could never be destroyed. This was at the heart of their religion. And on top of that, Pharaoh was viewed as a son of Amun-Re, S-O-N. He was a kind of incarnation of the Son, S-U-N, God, through whom Amun-Re was working his purposes in the world and blessing the Egyptians with life and prosperity. And what we've read is that in a moment of time, the God of the Israelites flips a switch and the sun goes out. It is not a momentary eclipse. It lasts for three whole days. The supposed source of life was overthrown and killed by Yahweh, and now all these people have to look forward to is death. God is sovereign. He rules over the realms of life and death. That is the message of all of this darkness. And it's no wonder then that throughout the scriptures, darkness, one of its other associations, is with judgment and with death. Such as Amos chapter 5, verse 20. Is not the day of the Lord darkness and not light and gloom with no brightness in it? Do you remember one of the labels or titles that Jesus gave actually to hell? He called it outer darkness. And to come back to Revelation chapter 16 and verse 10, the fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and its kingdom was plunged into darkness. Light is one of the basic components of life, and the Lord has the authority and the power to give it or to remove it. That is the message that is being portrayed here. And yet, I don't want to leave things on that somber note, because if God rules life and death, then he can also offer life to people on his terms. And one of the great images of spiritual life throughout the scriptures is precisely the image of light. We saw that all over the place as we did our study of 1 John a while ago. In fact, Jesus himself said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. This is the other side of this story. And in terms of the history of redemption, this is where the story is going. Are you crushed by the darkness and recognizing that all of your gods really don't have the ability to keep the lights on, as in to keep you alive forever? The God of the Bible says, I am the light of the world, and if you will follow me, you're going to have the light of life. So the question is, are you following him? Or are you seeking light somewhere else? And that brings us to the last truth that we learn from the darkness. We have seen that God desires to be known transgenerationally, that he rules over life and death, and finally now, God demands unconditional surrender. God demands unconditional surrender. I'm talking here about these ongoing foolish efforts that Pharaoh makes to try to bargain with God. And at the outset, the Lord frames a situation like this. He says to Pharaoh, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Chapter 10, verse 3. There's some irony there because that same word humble was used back in chapter 1 of how the Egyptians, Pharaoh, had humbled the Israelites by enslaving them. And now Yahweh is in the process of doing the same thing to Pharaoh, humbling him. If you won't humble yourself, is the point, you are going to be humbled by the Lord. And yet he keeps trying to negotiate. And when it comes to the locust, it's actually his own servants who say, are you crazy? Don't you see that we're being ruined? Let at least the men go. And so he takes that idea and he tries to say, well, just the males can go. Concept being that he's going to keep back the children and the women as hostages to make sure that the men come back. He accuses them of having some evil purpose in mind, which is kind of ironic as well, that he would be telling them that they have some evil purpose in mind. And the Lord is going to have none of that, and so we come to the plague about the darkness, and he's still wanting to negotiate. He says, all right, you can go, children, women, whatever, but keep the animals. And Moses is like, this is all about sacrifice. What are we going to sacrifice? It's the whole point why we want to go, at least initially. And depending on how this is translated, there's a little bit of an irony because you could also read verse 25 this way. Will you also provide us with sacrifices and burnt offerings that we may present them to Yahweh? In other words, all right, we'll leave our animals here. Now it's up to you to provide the animals that we need. What's the point if we're not going to have animals? And then Moses comes back and says dogmatically, our livestock must go with us, not a hoof shall be left behind. And I think about not a locust was left behind in the previous story, and he says, not a hoof is going to be left here of our animals. We must take them to serve the Lord. Pharaoh refuses to give in, but the Lord consistently refuses to accept any of the conditions or arguments that Pharaoh puts up. And after all of that, it is clear who it is that has the authority and the power to carry out his will. Who is going to win this argument? Who is going to win this conflict? By the end of the passage, these negotiations have just broken down entirely, and you have the stage set for the climactic plague where Pharaoh is finally going to drop to his knees. God will not be bargained with. You come to him on his terms, and the terms are unconditional surrender, just like with Pharaoh. Bible tells us that someday the whole world will drop to their knees and confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And yet, like Pharaoh, so often we foolishly act like we're the ones in charge and we can set the terms of the discussion. Some people may run away from God entirely and find some other sort of God that satisfies their desires. Some people may try to come up with their own ways of salvation, mixing up God's plan with some idea about themselves or their own works. When it comes to salvation, God is the one that gives the terms, and the folks, the terms are gloriously inflexible. Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and you will be saved. No one comes to the Father but through me. The Lord is the one who gives the terms, and he calls for unconditional surrender to that. And yet, even as believers in Christ, sometimes, maybe I'm the only one, but I find myself trying to make a deal with God. And folks, this is where what I start off with becomes so important. Your concept of God shapes how you interact with him. If God is the Lord of all, he didn't ask you for your permission or for your idea about how you are supposed to live. Lord means Lord. You come to him on his terms as a believer. But we do try to negotiate. Maybe trying to bend the rules a little bit. Or putting up conditions as to how or when we're going to serve him. Lord, I will do this if you will do the other for me that I want. Or I'll do this whenever it's a good time for me. Or I won't do this, but I'm going to go up to this point because to go further than that really makes me uncomfortable and I just don't like it. Or I'm going to give you these areas of my life, but these other areas really are under my domain and you don't have the authority over them, or I'm just going to kind of put you off. That is not how you interact with somebody that you claim is Lord of all. The Lord is sovereign over life and death, and included in that is our own daily lives and his expectations of us as his people. Unconditional surrender. We're going to talk a lot more about that, because once we finally do get these people out of Egypt, they're going to be standing in front of a mountain, and this God is going to say to them, look at all I've done for you. Now this is how you're to live. And he's going to state the terms. And yet, I don't want to end this message simply insisting on the lordship of Christ. I do want us to go away reflecting on who this Lord is that calls for our obedience and what he has done for us. And I pondered this the last couple weeks. It's been such a blessing to think about the idea of darkness for 3 days. That Jesus hung on a cross in darkness for exactly how long? 3 hours. Coincidence? I don't think so. What was happening on those 3 hours? He was suffering in our place the wrath of God that was falling on Egypt that you and I deserve to suffer. And he was in the grave for exactly how long? 3 days. Proving that he really had paid completely the penalty of death in our place. I leave you with this. It is because Jesus suffered the darkness of God's judgment that was coming to us that he then is able to offer to us life and resurrection and the kind of life that he calls his people to live. He suffered the darkness so that we wouldn't have to. And we're going to sing about that as we end this morning. Would you turn with me to hymn 148? This is a prayer that asks the Lord to help us enter into more fully the meaning of the cross and what Jesus suffered. Let's stand together and sing 148.